Great to have you here again this morning as we look at God's Word. We're going to be focusing our attention on the 14th chapter of the Gospel of Mark. And we've entitled this lesson, The Upper Room. The reason being that most of it took place in the upper room, or getting ready to go to that upper room. We'll begin our study in verse 12 and have some questions to ask. I want to convey, if I can, I'm trying to... Sometimes as you read the Bible and you get real familiar with something, and then maybe all of a sudden you go back and you look at it again and maybe close your eyes or you just visualize in your mind what the circumstances might have been like surrounding a particular event. And the particular event I have in mind, very familiar to all of us, was when Christ instituted the Lord's Supper. And sometimes I think we forget about the pervading atmosphere that surrounded that night and continued on from that point. The building up of the tension between Jesus and his enemies, all of the things that are happening here, and there's a sense of a shadowy darkness where Satan begins to get his plan hatched and bring about the death of Christ. So in verse 12, we'll just start there. On the first day of unleavened bread, when the Passover lamb was being sacrificed, his disciples said to him, "Where do you want us to go and prepare for you to eat the Passover?" Question. What does the disciples' question show us about Jesus' attitude toward the law of Moses? It had to be followed. Jesus always had a very concerned and always followed the law. And he was, of course, sinless, the only one who has ever lived that way. He lived and died under what law? The law of Moses. Jesus was a Jew. He was under the law of Moses. He was in the habit of keeping that law. Even at the early age, you might remember that his parents took him to Jerusalem, and that it was their habit to stay the full number of days. And so he grew up that way. He was always obedient in that way. Now, some people were wondering, I think maybe in the Gospel of John it says this, would he really come? Is he going to come or not? Why would they say that? Why would you come if the religious leaders had put out an arrest warrant on you, and if anybody saw you, they were to report it so that they could arrest him. So it became very tense as to whether or not he would come to that feast. So what historical events are commemorated by the Passover and the Feast of the Unleavened Bread? Let's start with the Passover. What is the historical event that is commemorated in that feast? Okay. The death of the firstborn during the 10th plague. And do you remember why they call it the Passover? Somebody? I know Michael answered this. If you don't, Colleen. Okay. There was a passing over that took place. And what happened is that if the blood of that Passover lamb were not sprinkled on the doorposts and lintel of your home, the firstborn would die. All of those in Egypt, any of the Israelites who didn't do it, it was the death of the firstborn, the last plague, the one that got them out of the land of Egypt. And so it commemorated that, and afterwards, it was their custom and the law that God gave about celebrating the Passover. And they were to do this each year. And the Passover was considered to be one of the three annual pilgrimages that the Jews would make to Jerusalem. And interesting to notice that this is the Passover before the death of Christ. Which is, you know, he's going to be dying the same time, basically, as the Passover feast is going on. and that there would be Jews in Jerusalem for that. Another feast 50 days later, the Pentecost, would also draw a lot of people into the city. So anyway, they had this feast, the death of the firstborn. All of that is taking place. And part of the feast of the Passover would be that you would find this Passover lamb. It had to be without spot or blemish. If this reminds you of Jesus, it's meant to remind you of Jesus. And they were to keep it for a certain number of days, and then on this particular day, they would sacrifice that lamb. And the blood would be sprinkled on the doorpost and lintel of the home. And what happened to the Passover lamb? Okay, they were to eat it in its entirety. If they had any left over, it would be burned with fire. So if you had if you were just a ma and pa living together in your little old house, and there's another family over here, and they had three or four members, and you figured out that Passover lamb could take 6-8 people, you might gather a couple of families together into one house. But you would get involved in the Passover feast, and you would not leave that house. You'd stay in that house until that Passover lamb was done and gone, and to make sure that you were following the customs and the commemoration exactly. Okay, what about the Feast of the Unleavened Bread? What did it commemorate? A little different, but actually very closely related to the Passover. What were the Jews supposed to get out of their house on the Passover? Yeast or leaven is another word for that. And so when you talk about unleavened bread and you connect it with the Lord's Supper and you say, okay, why do we eat this cracker? Well, just a regular cracker, you might look it up and find that it may have yeast in it, but this is the particular kind of bread they had in mind was unleavened bread. And the whole scene of the Passover, think about the special instructions. Do you know how they were supposed to eat this lamb? They're supposed to eat it all, but it was a eat it in haste. Eat it with your sandals on. It's roasted with fire. Eat it with bitter herbs. Leave nothing until the morning. And they were to eat it with their loins girded. What does that mean? Pardon me? Okay, you ready, guys, when you had long flowing robes, you tie them up. That's girding your loins so you could move faster. And they had a staff in their hand, and the idea was that they're getting ready in anticipation of God fulfilling his promise. And that's exactly what happened after the death of firstborn. Bam, the Pharaoh let them loose, and the people let them loose, and the people were told to ask for whatever they could ask for, gold, silver, and whatever. And actually the deliverance from Egypt was a deliverance without a shot being fired. And one of the most powerful countries in the world, nations in the world, was looted by slaves who left and took things with them. And maybe that's part of the reason why Egyptians came after them. They lost their slaves and they lost a lot of money as well. Unleavened bread. Some would have said that unleavened also may have a hint of connotation of purity. At least by New Testament times, when Jesus would say something like, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. Do what they say, but not what they do. Leaven is influence. 1 Corinthians 5 talks about removing the old leaven. And Christ as our Passover has been sacrificed. So there's kind of a connection here. The Passover followed immediately by 7 days of unleavened bread. That particular feast. And what came to be is that the Passover and the Feast of the Unleavened Bread were just began to be looked at as one thing, lasting 8 days. First day being the actual Passover, the rest being the Feast of the Unleavened Bread. But and so that may be why we read in Mark 14:1. Now the Passover and unleavened bread were 2 days away. Kind of puts them together. In chapter 14, verse 12, on the first day of unleavened bread, when the Passover lamb was being sacrificed, well, the Passover lamb was not sacrificed technically on the first day of unleavened bread, but the first day of the Passover and unleavened bread together for 8 days. So they looked at it that way, okay? And it's kind of hard to put us back into that setting. We have our motels and we have our places where people stay. And when the Jews came back to Jerusalem, they depended upon the hospitality of other Jews as to have a place to stay. And I know that some of these feasts, like Pentecost, we've read before in some history sources, maybe Josephus perhaps, where there might be in Jerusalem a great swelling of population. There might be 1 million people. That may be a high number. But the Jews were good about having people come and stay with them. Sometimes it might be in the upper room, which would be on the roof. If they had some room, they'd invite somebody in to stay with them. And so when they asked this question, it was a question that needed to be answered. Apparently, if Jesus and his disciples were in Bethany, and the previous section in Mark talks about this event of having the woman come in and pour the expensive perfume on Jesus and anoint him, take place in Bethany, there was a need to go into the city in order to celebrate this feast. So that's what they did. And they joined together. And in this particular setting, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but in this particular setting, you have a family setting normally, children and parents. You might have others, grandparents, extended family, others come in, and they're all together for this feast. And the father, in this case that would be Jesus, the family would be he and his apostles. And someone was designated, and I think this is arranged ahead of time, someone in the family, maybe a child, would ask the question, what does this all mean? And the father, whoever was in that position, would explain how the Passover lamb and all the events in Egypt, and talk to them about the unleavened bread and all of that, and this is what happened to our forefathers and so on. So that was a part of the deal when they celebrated the Passover. And in that way, they would never forget it. They would be commemorating it year after year after year. The Jews had a number of things like that that went on that I think were just pretty amazing memorials. The feasts were like that. The Feast of the Tabernacles, living in tents, in booths, had to be very, for a child growing up, what is this all about? And the parents would have an opportunity to teach them about their history. Now, what we're going to be talking about in a few moments, if we have time, is the institution of another memorial, the Lord's Supper. And this is very similar in some ways, because this is a memorial about the blood and about the body of Jesus sacrificed for us on the cross. And so it becomes another one of those things. We do it every week, but as parents, children ask questions. We have opportunity to explain things to them. And if they don't ask, we need to teach them anyway, right? So it's a time for us to remember. It teaches us, it reminds us, and it teaches the next generation. Let's go to verses 13 through 16 now. And he sent two of his disciples and said to them, go into the city, and a man will meet you carrying a pitcher of water. Follow him, and wherever he enters, say to the owner of the house, the teacher says, where is my guest room in which I may eat the Passover with my disciples? and he himself will show you a large upper room furnished and ready. Prepared for us there. The disciples went out and came to the city and found it just as he told them, and they prepared the Passover. They're asking, where do you want us to do this? Jesus answered them. He sent two of them. Luke's account mentions that's Peter and John. So again, you see how having several synoptic accounts can give you fuller information. So what instructions? Now, let's break it down. What instructions did he tell them? Step one, step two, step three. What's the first thing they're supposed to do? Okay, before that, go into the city, and then you would find someone, a man, carrying a pitcher of water. And I thought, I read a commentary on this that said, that would be unusual to see a man carrying a pitcher of water. Why? Okay, well, that came out fast. At least somebody didn't say, that's women's work. It wasn't usual. The women did carry the water. And you think about modern inventions, and you think about our indoor plumbing, water that we turn on with a faucet. And back in the day when they had to carry their water, go to the well and get the water. We have such an easy life by comparison. Go into the city, meet a man carrying a pitcher of water. And thirdly, follow him. Here's the thing that's absent. There are no words exchanged, from all we know. They just went into the city. Ah, there he is. And they followed him. And you think back, keep in mind that there may have been a little intrigue, a little secrecy to this, when you consider that there was a warrant out on Jesus. And these two men come in there, and Jesus and the disciples won't actually come until after dark. But if they could catch Jesus alone, they would nab him. So these two come in there, they follow him, and what was the next thing they were supposed to do? Go into the house and then ask the question to the owner of the house. What question was that? Excuse me. Where's the guest room that my teacher said, go get this guest room? So you think about that for a moment, and you have to ask yourself the question, how was this prearranged? How did Jesus know that there would be a man carrying water, that man would lead them to the house, and then the owner say, yes, I got it ready, come on up here? There are some things left out that are not included that we'd like to know. That things had to have been relayed somewhere. Either Jesus prearranged it, or the man at the house had received special revelation or instruction, maybe from a dream or something. But in any case, it worked out exactly the way that Jesus said it would. Where is my guest room? That's kind of interesting. I had a note about this upper room. Could this upper room have been the same one mentioned in Acts chapter 2 or Acts chapter 1? It's possible. It may have been. They were in an upper room there, 120 people. Maybe it was a different place. But it possibly could have been. And of course, we know, we don't know this, but there's a place in Jerusalem now, it's called the Cenacle, C-E-N-A-C-L-E. Never heard that word before. But it's pronounced just like cynical, and somebody is a cynical person, you know, doubting everything. That's spelled C-Y-N-I-C-A-L, Cenacle. Cenacle is a place that, like they often did, the Catholics would do this. There'd be an event that they found, and they found a place attached to it. Sometimes they didn't find that particular place, but they might invent a place where it's at. Not every place in Palestine around Jerusalem is the place that they'll tell you that it is if you go over there on a tour. A lot of them, they just don't know. But they built a cenacle over the top of this place where the upper room was. And by now, I'm sure it had been destroyed or torn down, but where they thought it was. So you can actually go to this upper room today. It's probably, I would say it's not the same one, but they would claim that it was. But in any case, what all this says to us, and I'll just say this very briefly, is that Jesus was in control. He had control over things. You know, go into town, you'll see a man carrying water, follow him, go into the house, talk to the owner, it's ready, and everything's ready for him. That's the way it was. It wasn't anything about this period of Jesus' life that was left in chaos. There was no sudden, unforeseen, unexpected uprising against him. Jesus knew that was the way it was going to be. There's a similar event that happened just a couple of chapters earlier in Mark chapter 11. And they were headed to Jerusalem right before this last final week. And they had got up close to the Mount of Olives or near the crest. And he sent two of his disciples into a place, to a little city there. And he said, go in there and you'll find a colt tied there upon which no one has sat. Untie it and bring it here. And if anybody says anything to you, say the master has need for it. Yes, Rod? Yes, I would agree that very likely the master of the house may have been a disciple. And some say, well, maybe they've partaken of the Passover there before. There's three of them. The only thing is I don't think you'd need directions on how to get there. So, but Jesus has control of the situation. Now, verses 17 through 21. When it was evening, he came with the 12. As they were reclining at the table and eating, Jesus said, truly I say to you that one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me. They began to be grieved and say to him, one by one, surely not I. And he said to them, it is one of the 12 who dips with me in the bowl. For the Son of Man is to go just as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would be better for him, it would have been good for that man if he had not been born. That's a, again, you think about it's evening. They're sitting down, they're commemorating, they're eating the Passover feast. And Jesus begins talking about this and the pervading influence of this. It's interesting that in chapter 13, at the end of the chapter, he mentions Peter denying him. And then they get together, they're celebrating the Passover, and he mentions someone's betraying me. And later, he talks some more about them being scattered and Peter denying him three times. So there's a lot of emotion in all of this situation. When you think about the events during this supper, there's a lot more than just Mark talks about. There's chapter 13 through 16 or so in the Gospel of John where it's expanded out to what he's talking about. But there's a lot of things going on here, but there's a lot of troubled hearts, a lot of questioning going on, and Jesus is actually doing something very important. He's not adding You know, in a manner of speaking, you say, well, he's just making it worse. Well, he's not. If you go to John 13, verses 17 through 19, the question is, why did Jesus predict his own betrayal? Let me read that. After he washed the feet of the disciples, Jesus said, if you know these things, you're blessed if you do them. Talking about washing one another's feet, serving each other. I do not speak of all of you. I know the ones who I have chosen, but it is that the scripture may be fulfilled. He who eats my bread has lifted up his heel against me. That's a prediction of betrayal. From now on, I'm telling you before it comes to pass, so that when it does occur, you may believe that I am he. Why did Jesus tell the disciples he was going to die? He was going to be betrayed. He was going to be denied. His disciples were scattered like sheep. Why does he predict all of those elements? Okay, he is a prophet. And when it happened, the disciples would be encouraged in a roundabout way because Jesus said this would happen. They might not have figured it out right then, but later on they would see it. In this case, of course, Jesus predicting exactly what would happen ahead of time. And so predicting it ahead of time, they could then see it and say, okay, Jesus is who he claimed to be, right? I'm going to just ask a few more questions and try to wrap this up a little bit. How did the disciples feel about the prediction? About the betrayal, I mean. Yeah, that's true about his denial. Yeah. About the betrayal, it's almost like they were grieved, but they were shocked. And they couldn't think of anyone who could do that. So they asked, surely not I. Surely not I. And one of the Gospels said, one by one they asked this. And you get the sense that even Judas asked it. And then in John's account, you have, remember, they're sitting at a table, reclining. You lean on one elbow and you eat with the other hand, and the person next to you is right here. So the person on the right of Jesus, the disciple whom Jesus loved, many people think it's John, and Peter's there. And Peter suggests to John, and John asks, tell us who it is. And Jesus, according to the Gospel of John, identifies the traitor by dipping it and giving it to Judas. Apparently, from what John wrote, nobody else caught on because they thought, well, he's going out to buy food or to feed the poor or whatever. And so they get they identify him, and Jesus says, what you do, do quickly. Now, Judas is gone now. So a lot of the things that happen in the upper room, and many of those things that you read about in the Gospel of John, the encouraging words of chapter 14, 15, and 16, are things that Judas didn't have a part of. But the disciples didn't catch on at that point. Now, it is interesting to look at the Gospel of John because John is the one who, and it's supposedly written later on, toward the end of the first century, and he's very clear about Judas being the one who's going to betray him. And some of the others did that as well. Okay. I want to then think about this woe pronounced upon Judas. It would have been better never to have been born. That's a pretty bad thing. You probably would have, what's going to happen to you, you'd probably rather have not been born. There are some things like that in the Bible. You think about even 2 Peter, where it talks about those who have escaped the defilements of the world through the knowledge of Jesus Christ and turn again it would have been better never to have known the way of righteousness than after having known it to turn away from it. And describes that person, it'd be like a dog returning to its vomit and a sow after washing returning to wallowing in the mire. There are some things in life that become so despicable, it'd be better never to have been born. But we might keep in mind the fact that it all starts small. Judas didn't just all of a sudden wake up and want to have Jesus killed. It start with maybe a little extra greed, a little this, a little that. In our lives, the same thing happens. And the complete betrayal might not happen for a while. But a little step in sin leads to a bigger step and a bigger step. And farther and farther we go until one day finding our way back can be difficult, very difficult. And we may never find our way back. I'm not talking to those people here tonight, but this is the danger that we have. To take heed when you think you stand, lest you fall. I'm an apostle of Jesus Christ. And an apostle of Jesus Christ ended up betraying him. How could you do that? If he was among those who said, "Surely not I," you say, well, that's kind of hypocritical. That's unbelievable that he would do that. Well, how about walking up to Jesus in the garden and kissing him on the face? How could he do that either? And suddenly when the cards came falling down and everything around him crumbled in, he realized he had betrayed an innocent man. There was nothing he could do about it. He had remorse, but he had no repentance, and he went out and hanged himself. Horrible, horrible event. Now, thinking about all that in the background, it's then that Jesus took some bread. And after a blessing, he broke it and gave it to them and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." And when he had taken a cup and given thanks, he gave it to them, and they all drank from it. And he said to them, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many. Truly I say to you, I will never again drink from the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in my Father's kingdom." After singing a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. When you think about that, about all the background of the Passover and all the things that are happening in the darkness, the betrayal, that all the disciples would flee from him. Peter, "I'm not going to do it." "Yes, you are. Three times you're going to deny me." All of that going on at that time. Jesus thinking ahead. "This is my body. This is my blood." Not literally. "It represents my body. It represents my blood. Do this in remembrance of me." It really is an emotional pact, and very, very important for us to understand. I'm going to stop there. We're way out of time. Thank you, and we'll have an invitation song. If you need our prayers, need to complete your obedience to Christ, we'll invite you to come while we stand and while we sing.